The government is in a position to end this case and to free them.
Myanmar convicts two Reuters journalists for Rohingya coverage. It's Tuesday, September 4th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Please join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China offers investment and promises less debt for Africa. Massive weddings without the cost. Chinese farming in the United States. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. sharply condemned the conviction of two Reuters journalists in Myanmar and their 7-year prison terms for violating the country's secrecy laws, calling it deeply troubling and a major setback in the Southeast Asian country's efforts to promote democratic reforms. The U.S. Embassy in Myanmar, also known as Burma, said the clear flaws in the case against the journalists, Wallon and Chaw-Soo, raise serious concerns about the rule of law and judicial independence in Myanmar. The two were covering the brutal military campaign in Rakhine State that has driven nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims across the border into Bangladesh since last August. They were focused on the massacre of 10 Rohingya by police and soldiers in the village of Indin. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Reuters editor-in-chief Stephen Adler about the verdict.
I was very disappointed with the verdict because there was really no evidence against them. All of the evidence suggested that they were innocent and that it was a blatant setup. So it was really upsetting and, though not surprising, because the fact that they were arrested and the fact that they were charged suggested that they were going to be convicted, because there was no evidence at any stage of the proceeding. There was no due process. There was no rule of law. So it was not that surprising that they were then convicted.
But this, everybody is saying, served as a possible statement that they were freeing things up as far as their government was concerned.
The fact that they were arrested under these circumstances, and we now know the arrest was a setup. A police captain testified at the trial that they had been instructed to provide documents to these two reporters and then to arrest them with the documents and claim that they had secret documents. And I think the goal was to stop them from reporting, but also to deter other journalists from looking too closely at what was going on.
Do you expect this to have a chilling effect on journalism, or do you think it might be the opposite?
It certainly isn't having a chilling effect on us. Even since they've been in prison, we published the story that they were working on that the government clearly didn't want published. And we've written 4 or 5 other, I think, very important investigative pieces in Myanmar. And I noticed that the global press is very much involved in covering what's going on there, covering what's happening in the refugee camps in Bangladesh. So I am concerned about the chilling effect on journalism in Myanmar, but I'd also note that reporters there have backed Wallon and Chaw-Soo very strongly. They've come to court, they've rallied, they've demonstrated, they've worn T-shirts.
Do you expect these prison terms to be fully carried out?
I certainly hope not. Our goal now would be to try very much to persuade and to bring about the a pardon or some sort of end to this. The government is in a position to end this case and to free them, and it would not in any way interfere with the court process because the process of the trial is over. We think that there's no time like the present to get them out. They've been in there for 9 months for doing absolutely nothing wrong except doing journalism in the public interest. So we very much don't want to allow a lot of time to pass. We see this as a matter of enormous urgency, and we hope people don't lose interest. Sometimes in these situations, people are interested for a while, and then they move on to something else. But this is one where we need sustained interest so that Wallon and Chaw-Soo can go back to their families and go back to doing the jobs they are supposed to be doing.
Reuters editor-in-chief Stephen Adler speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. U.S. Ambassador Scott Marcil told VOA the verdict was sad for the journalists and their families, but moreover, he said, one has to ask whether this process will increase or decrease the confidence that the Myanmar people have in their justice system. The two journalists were charged with violating the Official Secrets Act, which was enacted in 1923 when Myanmar was called Burma and was under British colonial rule. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. China pledges fresh $60 billion to Africa, says no political strings attached. China's JD.com founder returns to Beijing after U.S. arrest. Hope and caution as Kim Jong-un shifts to North Korea's economy. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You'll also find them on our VOAnews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We continue with VOA Asia. China is hosting the two-day triennial forum on China-Africa cooperation in Beijing. It is the seventh such meeting. Africa is the recipient of billions from China's so-called Belt and Road Infrastructure Development Program. More than 50 African heads of state are in attendance. David Shin is a former diplomat and adjunct professor in international affairs at the George Washington University. VOA's Victor Beatty asked him if debt to China is a growing concern among these countries.
It is for some African countries, not all. It's 54 African countries. There are different debt situations in every one of them. There are several that, in fact, there are, I believe, five, according to the International Monetary Fund, that are now deeply indebted, and there are another 11 that are in strong threat of being deeply indebted. Now, not all of that debt, though, is with China. In fact, in most cases, most of the debt is not. It is with international financial institutions and other countries. China is the major debt holder in several of the countries. And in those countries, obviously, it is an issue of concern.
China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi told his African counterparts on Sunday that President Xi Jinping will use the summit as an opportunity to outline a specific vision on building a China-Africa community with a shared future and announce proposals and measures to strengthen China-Africa cooperation. What does he mean?
The whole concept of the shared future is one of the new mantras of the Xi Jinping administration. And I think that means different things to different people. There will be very specific agreements that come out of this meeting in Beijing, as has been the case with all of the previous FOCAC meetings. But the whole concept of the shared values between China and Africa is a little fuzzier, and I think it really is in the mind of the beholder.
China's clout, of course, has grown exponentially over the years. According to Standard Bank Group's Asia operation, some 300 companies account for a majority of China's business activity, but the region also has some 30,000 smaller Chinese firms that are of growing importance. Obviously, China is having a huge influence on the continent.
It's possible that if you include all the Chinese restaurants and acupuncture operations involving one individual, you may get up to a number of 30,000. And it is, you're quite right, it has a very important impact upon the continent. There certainly are more Chinese companies operating in Africa today than there are American companies.
David Shin said China's military base in the Horn of Africa country Djibouti is the first outside of China and clearly shows its growing security interest on the continent. At the same time, he cautions China's clout in Africa can be overstated. For instance, he said China only represents about 5% of all foreign direct investment in Africa, while that is dwarfed by the combined investments of European countries and, to a lesser extent, that of the United States. Still, China has become the continent's biggest bilateral trading partner. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Every culture has its own traditions for wedding ceremonies. Some throw massive parties and invite hundreds of guests, while others enjoy the occasion with close friends and family. In India and Pakistan, weddings can be very costly, and ancient cultural traditions like requiring a dowry can prevent girls from getting married due to their family finances. Now a non-governmental organization in Srinagar, Kashmir, is helping Indian parents and couples lower the financial burden by organizing mass marriage events where over 100 couples tie the knot. VOA's Zubair Dar takes us to one of these joint ceremonies in this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Weddings in Indian-administered Kashmir have become very expensive, and a common problem for many Kashmiri families is simply not being able to pay for it. In a region where marriages are commonly arranged by parents, it is becoming more and more difficult for them to afford suitable life partners for their sons and daughters. Now, a local non-governmental organization called Jeffrey Council has found a way to lower the cost by organizing a massive wedding for many couples at the same time.
We noticed that folks had unmarried sons and daughters over 30. We thought we should work on this.
In a single event, 105 Kashmiri couples tied the knot. Sayyid Tanveer Hussain thought it was the best way to start married life.
The marriage ceremony went really well. I think that everyone should get married the way we got married.
Couples tying the knot here say that they can enjoy the marriage more by not having the stress of starting their life together with a large debt. For Yusuf Jamil in Srinagar, this is Bejan Hamdad, VOA News.
Coming up, ancient Chinese farming takes root in the United States. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news from VOA Asia, two Malaysian women convicted under Islamic law for homosexuality were publicly caned Monday. The two unidentified women, ages 32 and 22, were punished in front of about 100 witnesses at a Sharia court. Human rights groups have expressed outrage about the verdict. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues in Minnesota, Hmong farmers have banded together to make a better living. Originally from China, the Hmong are an Asian ethnic group that migrated to Vietnam and Laos in the 18th century, but they have never had a country of their own. After the Vietnam War ended, many resettled in the United States, and now decades later, Hmong farmers are at the center of a local foods economy in Minnesota. VOA's June So has more in this report, narrated by Carol Pearson.
On a Friday, Mi Hang picks flowers to sell at a local farmer's market over the weekend. Mao Mua and her husband pick vegetables, also for a farmer's market.
We bought corn, sweet potato, then gao cherry, cucumber, snap pea, had a little bit of cherry tomato, that's all.
Hang and Mua's families were among a mass exodus of Hmong people fleeing Laos for Thailand in the 1970s. Ever since they resettled in the U.S., they have been farming in Minnesota in recent years on a membership farm.
I like farming on the Hafa farm because this is a Hmong association. There are Hmong workers who help us. They are like our hands, eyes, and ears. I like there is also water, electricity, and the food hub.
So happy.
Since 2011, the nonprofit Hmong American Farmers Association, also known as HAFA, runs the 63-hectare farm outside St. Paul, Minnesota. Member farmers have a long-term lease on 2 to 4 hectare parcels to grow their vegetables and flowers. With more than 60,000, Minnesota has the second largest Hmong population in the country.
Within the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, Hmong farmers make up about 50% of all produce growers selling at the farmers markets. The Hmong growers' participation in the farmers market has really revitalized the farmers market.
HAFA also operates an alternative markets program called Food Hub. Hang says Hmong farmers have fueled a freshly grown local food movement. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Dakota County, Minnesota.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online, iTunes and SoundCloud, our VOA Asia Facebook stream, and of course our website. Always a good place to get our program as well as the many other great programs that VOA produces. That would be voanews.com. We also have great people here who produce our programs, including director Tracy Carter, engineer Greg Burns, our managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Please write to us if you can. VOA Asia at voanews.com is our address. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great day. We'll see you again tomorrow.